Turn up the radio as loud as it'll go. You can go to the agogo or duck inside a disco, but you can't make it go away. It's gaining on you every day. It's only natural anyway, and you can't make it go away. And medically evacuate your brain. Turn into TV till your eyes go lame. You can grab on the god, you can lock him in your pocket. You can even stick your fingers in the light bulb socket. But you can't make it go away. It's gaining on you every day. It's only natural anyway. And you can't make it go away. From where you stand, invent statistics to insult and degrade. You can make us illegal, you can lock us in the stockade, but you can't make us go away. We're gaining on you every day. It's only natural anyway.
Good morning, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Roland. Be with you for the next hour. That was Jim Page, You Can't Make It Go Away. We're going to continue our discussion on climate change here with a guest that we intended to have on for the full hour last week, and now we do have him on for the full hour. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. How are you,
Paul? I'm good, and this is Paul Beckwith with the Paleontology Lab at the University of Ottawa. Is that right?
Yes.
Good.
Yes,
I had a
paleoclimatology.
And we're going to talk a lot about your background. I want to kind of start out with that. But before we get into that, I have a couple community announcements. This is today's community announcement. On July 6, 2013, 47 people were killed in Quebec, Canada, in North America's deadliest oil train derailment. As part of the annual U.S. and Canadian observation of Stop Oil Trains Week of Action, Oregonians will gather to remember the lives of those who died there with spoken word, visual art, and music. The event is today, July 6th, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square. It is sponsored by the Climate Action Coalition. I'm sure you remember that deadly train accident up in Canada. We can talk a little bit about that as well. Tomorrow, Thursday, July 7th, from 7 to 9 p.m., I mentioned this last week, Beyond Fossil Fuel Exports, A Just Transition to a Clean and Equitable Economy for Portland. That's at the First Unitarian Church, Southwest 12th and Main. Join Fight for 15 advocates, Seattle City Councilor Kashama Sawant, Joe Uline of Labor Network for Sustainability, Vancouver, BC, City Councilor Andrea Reimer, and Just Transition Alliance Director Jose Bravo at a public forum on how Portland can lead the country away from fossil fuel export infrastructure and toward a cleaner and more equitable economy. And a related event, the next day, Friday, July 8th, you can check out Joe Uline in another venue and vein on an entertaining evening of music and dialogue about the climate crisis and economic crisis. He's reviving the old style of the song speech. That's at the Musicians Hall, 325 Northeast 20th, just south of Sandy in Portland at 7 p.m. And this Sunday, Vietnam Revisited with S. Brian Wilson. It's July 10th at 2:30 p.m. at Unite Oregon, formerly the CIO office, 700 North Killingsworth near Albina. The Air Force veteran anti-imperialist activist will describe how this year's trip to Vietnam was his first voluntary return to that country. S. Brian Wilson is the author of Blood on the Tracks and the subject of the new documentary, which was just played recently at the Clinton Street Theater, I believe on Sunday, Paying the Price for Peace. For more info, Peace and Justice Works, Iraq Affinity Group. That's Iraq at pjw.info. If you have any announcements that are important and you would like to get on the air, you can do that through our program of co-sponsorship, and that's get in touch with Ani Haynes, volunteer coordinator at volunteer@kbo.org. You can also have them read on the air. Write to me at paulrkboo@gmail.com. And once again, my guest this morning is Peter Beckwith, professor of... No, I'm sorry, I'm looking at my old show. Why don't you just say what you do?
Yeah, Paul Beckwith. So I'm at the University of Ottawa in the Department of Geography. I have a part-time professor designation because I teach, and that's what the university calls people that teach. I've taught climatology, meteorology, sort of introductory courses, about three times, I guess. I've taught oceanography course and also third-year courses, geographical approaches to environmental issues, so just all about environmental issues, you know. I also research on abrupt climate change. Basically, I look at the climate system, all the different components and pieces, and try to determine how it, what it's doing now, try to make some projections as to what it's going to do in the near term and, you know, further term future, based on what it's done in the past, both near term and far term.
So now climatology, or, you know, the general study of climate systems, seems to embrace a wide variety of disciplines. Of course, there's climatologists, but there's also, like, Peter Wadhams studies ocean, is a professor of ocean physics. He also seems to have a wide range of knowledge. So what encompasses the field of climatology today?
Yeah. So, you know, the climate, there's all kinds of different disciplines that are studying, that are, you know, involved as sort of pieces of the climate system change puzzle. And in general, most scientists at universities are very, very specialized. They're all specialists. I mean, they're, you know, you might have a specialist in glaciers on, but, you know, a glaciologist may spend an entire, you know, 4 or 5 years to get their PhD studying the movement of one particular glacier in one particular region of the world. Like, it's, you know, the ultimate in specialization, learning everything you can, you know, about that particular glacier more than anybody else in the world knows, and, you know, write, you know, peer-reviewed papers on your results. You know, so that's just one example. I mean, there's people, you know, oceanographers, and then there's all these subspecialties within that. Do you study the plankton? Do you study the chemistry? Do you study the physics of the ocean, light properties? You know, once again, you get, you know, very, very fine tooth comb specialization, atmospheric physics, earth physics, the methane, for example, the sea ice, right? There's all of these different areas. So when the media, when the mainstream media is looking to, you know, when the story is coming out, the mainstream media will then go to the specialists in all of these separate areas and get them to talk on those areas. The problem is there's way too many specialists and there's not enough people that are looking at the overall system. I like to use the analogy of chess, since I love playing the game of chess, and the individual specialties would be one particular square on the chessboard and one piece on that particular square. So everything is known about that particular square and part of the chessboard, but the big picture of the entire board is not seen. Knowing everything about one square does not allow you to play a game of chess. It does not allow you to understand the interrelationship from one square to another square on the board and the connections between all the pieces. The best chess players can figure out the best move very quickly because they have a sort of whole database of pattern recognition built into their brain. And they, you know, they know certain areas of the board, what it means, and they can, you can almost look at the board and know what the best move is right away. Whereas somebody who's just learning chess, weighs each smooth and each square equally and doesn't have a filter of pattern recognition to come up with a good move. So I like to use that analogy. I try to look at the entire climate system. I look at the oceanography. I look at the atmospheric physics. I look at the methane. I look at all the different parts, and I try to figure out how the system is changing. And there's very few people that look at the whole system. Yet in order to solve, you know, in order to understand the climate system and what's happening and where it's going, you really need to have this, you know, much wider view than the typical scientist, you know, at a university would have.
So that's one problem, is actually understanding what's going on. And what I'm arguing from my extremely amateur dilettante perspective, not a trained scientist, but feel like I'm beginning to have something of a grasp of what's going on from doing a lot of reading. So understanding the nature of the problem is one big issue. Even within the scientific community, as you say, there's such specialization, there's such a lack of coordination. Let's bracket that. I want to get back to that in a couple minutes, but that's not the only system involved, the climate system, unfortunately, or whatever. There's also economic systems, political systems, psychological systems. There's all these interacting systems that, I think we're all called upon to understand them as well. And, you know, understanding what's going on with the climate is maybe just even the first step. You know, even people who get to understand, who feel like they understand, like yourself and Peter Wadhams and other people, don't have much power to influence the social systems that are driving climate change. So, okay, we'll just respond to that. And I want to get back to the question of understanding what's going on.
Yeah. So the only power that we have really is to try to explain what we understand about the climate system to as many different people as possible, not just people in government, not just politicians, but the general public as well, because it's the general public that push the political systems to come up with policy. And also we need to throw into the equation that the fact that there's, you know, many people who are backing just the status quo, and it is in their best interest for their fields and professions and jobs that real information about the climate system, for example, and how bad it is, not get out to the public. You know, to keep their industries going. I'm talking about the fossil fuel industry mostly. So there, you know, there's lots of money behind their attempt to misinform the public on how serious climate change is. And we're still seeing this. This is still ongoing and very strong. But I think what's happening is that the changes in the climate system are now happening so fast and so frequent and so furious that there's no way what's happening cannot be picked up and recognized by the public as, hey, something's not right here. I mean, if you want, you can talk about any different climate change parameter. You can talk about CO2 levels in the atmosphere, for example. In 2015, we had a rise of over 3 parts per million. This year, it's probably looking to be over 4 or higher even. And this is, you know, these are record high levels. And these are in coming out in the context that the International Energy Agency and other groups are saying that fossil fuel emissions are stabilizing. The rise of fossil fuel emissions is slowing down. Yet, if this is the case, why are the levels in the atmosphere still going up at record rates? That's just one aspect. You can look at temperatures. I mean, Paris was all about, you know, 2 degrees originally, rise above pre-industrial, then down to 1.5 degrees. That's in Celsius, multiplied by 1.8. So, you know, a 2-degree rise is a 3.6-degree Fahrenheit rise. So Paris was all about those numbers. And meanwhile, you know, in the first 3-4 months of this year, we exceeded that 1.5 number. In fact, the month of February, I think, was about 1.6 or 1.7 or 1.8 degrees Celsius higher than pre-industrial. So we're already exceeding those numbers. You know, we're setting records. I mean, temperatures have skyrocketed this year. Maybe they'll stabilize a bit after the strong El Nino passes, but with other strong El Ninos, like after the 97-98 El Nino went through, the temperatures didn't continue to rise at the same rate, but they didn't drop down to the previous levels that they were at. They kind of reached a new level and rose from there. You can look at methane emissions coming up, mostly from the Arctic region, also from wetlands, various places, and see the levels continuing to rise at record high rates. You can look at melt rates from Greenland and Antarctic ice caps rising at exponential rates, so with a doubling period of 5 to 8 years typically. You can look at the exponentially rising rate of sea level. You can look at the migration of flora and fauna on the planet. There's just so many parameters. I mean, what really got me to start saying we're in a climate emergency is about 3 or 4 months ago when we all heard about the destruction of coral reefs around the world, you know, most specifically in the Great Barrier Reef in Australia.
So I think we risk sometimes in getting into this, all this detail, in sort of overwhelming ourselves or
right.
with facts. But hold on a second. So the issue of you mentioned something on, you know, what really got me interested in your work. One of the things was the first video I saw of you where you mentioned the sort of Twilight Zone aspect, which really struck me as an appropriate metaphor. The idea that there's this thing going on that is so big and so vast, yet it seems as if it's not happening. You know, sure, you can, you know, if you live in a place like, obviously, if you live in Bangladesh and you suffered this 120 degree or whatever heat wave, you know, and suffered tremendously, you're not going to forget that anytime real soon. Or, you know, if you suffered those record-breaking floods in West Virginia or Texas, obviously you're still having to deal with that. But, you know, here in our listening area, we are in a relatively fortunate area climatically in terms of, you know, it's actually rather cool here. We're not in an extreme drought like California. So, you know, places in the world where these things aren't happening directly, and even, you know, even places where they do happen, that you know, there's still enough money and ability to respond that the recovery is still able to happen, at least in wealthy nations, you know, relatively rapidly. That might change, you know. So people are able to get on with their lives, and, you know, so it's, and then maybe even, you know, we focus on that rather than on the big picture. I think that's a big part of the problem. So
yes.
So this issue of like the disconnect between, you know, people who are studying this intently like yourself, who feel like you have a good grasp on what's going on, and see this basically this asteroid coming at the Earth, you know, point blank within however many years it's happening, we're already feeling the effects, as opposed to, you know, the vast amount of the general public that are still in various stages of either denial or ignorance, or, you know, maybe it's not that bad, or maybe, you know, what we're doing is sufficient to respond. That disconnect is what I want to really get at, because I think it's really hard for people to put themselves in your shoes and really fully feel like they fully understand what's going on.
Yes, the disconnect is definitely, you know, it's I mean, it's like there's a huge, you know, chasm. It's like you're on, you know, it's like the public's on one side of the Grand Canyon and, you know, the scientists are on the other side. No, you know, and I shouldn't really say the scientists, like just a small subset of the scientists who are looking at the overall big picture, you know, and not just looking at their specialty and not trying to put that in context with the whole system. I mean, I would really encourage you know, every scientist, no matter in what field, to actually, you know, devote, you know, spend a week, you know, just go, you know, not studying your field, just go completely out of your familiarity. You know, if you're studying glaciers, go and look at what the oceans are doing. Look at what the oxygen levels are doing in the ocean. Look at what the jet streams are doing in the atmosphere. Look at what the ocean currents are doing. Look at what the Arctic's doing. And just try to, you know, learn a little bit about the whole system. And because I think it's very, it doesn't take a lot of effort or a lot of work for somebody with some technical knowledge to actually come to a conclusion themselves that is very similar to my conclusion. That, you know, we have an emergency situation. I mean, we're stressing our planet in so many ways that we're starting to get massive failures of systems, and it is going to affect everybody on the planet very, very soon. Probably the biggest effect will be a big, huge hit to the global food supply, which will then drive up prices, and people will recognize that there is a crisis when this happens. We can talk about, you know, you mentioned the California drought. So things from California, you know, they provide a lot of the vegetables and fruits and things to the entire country of the U.S. as well as other places. You know, we get most of our food in the winter from California up in Canada here. So when this drought really affects the supply and there's shortages and prices are driven up, as far back as 2010, the jet streams were so wavy that there was a persistent ridge over Russia, and they lost 20% of their grain crop and they didn't export grain that year. Food prices spiked for grains in the Middle East, and then the Arab Spring crisis was precipitated. The Syrian drought in 2006 to 2010 was the largest drought in their history, and it put 1.5 million farmers out of work. You know, so these people went from the rural areas to the cities. There was huge unemployment, huge unrest, and Syria basically split apart. We're seeing things happen, sort of, you know, large events happening, but they're not generally synchronized. They're sort of sporadic. So when they happen more and more frequent, the probability that there's going to be a lot of overlap of these events is much, much higher. And, you know, the root cause. So part of my job, I see, is just trying to, you know, dissect the science, however complicated it may be, into very human terms, into very, you know, easily understood terms, with using lots of metaphors and things like that, just to try to explain how things are changing. So, you know, I think the most important thing for people to understand is that the enormous changes of the enormous temperature rises in the Arctic are due to a darkening Arctic, losing snow and sea ice. And the Arctic is warming from the sun extremely fast, and the entire jet streams, which circle the circumvent the planet in the northern hemisphere anyway, are weakening because they're formed because of this temperature difference with the equator. So as the temperature difference decreases, they become slower and wavier, moving much further south and much further north. Now, how north have they gone? Well, we saw them go up to the North Pole in December 2015 and also, you know, early this year on a few different occasions. They went right up to the North Pole, the ridges of these jet streams, and they brought temperatures above zero to the North Pole in the middle of winter. How far south are they going? They're going extremely far south. And in fact, the big question for me was, what are they going to do if they go far enough south that they interact in the equatorial region? And this is why I was so interested in seeing the jet streams crossing the equator in a perpendicular fashion. I'm not talking about a monsoons, which may draw air across the equator, which is what other meteorologists are saying. Well, this has happened before. You know, we get air going across the equator all the time. Yes, we do from a monsoon, and most of that transport is parallel or at a slight angle to the equator. This is a perpendicular crossing of the equator in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and it was clearly the northern hemisphere jet stream, the subtropical jet stream, looping around, crossing the equator, joining with the southern hemisphere jet stream. So a lot of science has to be done to determine, you know, the frequency of occurrence, you know, what is really happening. But this fits into the pattern of the jet stream changes that I have been following for many, many years. So it's another piece of the puzzle of how our climate system is reorganizing, how it's changing, how weather patterns are changing.
So let's give the number for people to call. I'm speaking with Paul Beckwith, he's a part-time professor with the Laboratory for Paleoclimatology and Climatology in the Department of Geography at the University of Ottawa. And he studies abrupt climate change in the past and the present. And the number is 503-231-8187 to participate in this conversation. You know, something I think a lot about is sort of the disaster movie scenario, you know, where obviously there's the films about comets where, you know, everybody is forced to get together. I think there's the famous sci-fi movie where somebody, Klaatu, I believe, comes down to Earth, and there's a threat. There's a general threat to the Earth, and he forces people to come together. And I guess there's like a nuclear threat. Anyway,
yes.
People are finally come together and combat this common threat. There's the, you know, people, the scientists get together to come up with a missile to deflect the asteroid that's hurtling towards Earth, you know. And then on the other hand, there's movies like Jaws where there's this threat, a terrible threat off the coast of Massachusetts, and the Chamber of Commerce, the business interests have to minimize the threat because it's going to threaten tourism, you know. So you get, on the one hand, the heroic disaster movie where, you know, the people get together and save the day from this huge threat. On the other hand, there's these other threats that are minimized because they threaten economic interests. And that seems to be, it's sort of climate change is like the super version of that story, where you have this existential threat to life on Earth that seems to be real, although there seems to be a general denial of it. Yet the business community led by the fossil fuel interests have been minimizing it ever since, you know, they were some of the early ones to know about it, you know, 30, 40 years ago, and right, had their own scientists study and suppress that evidence. And it just seems, again, there seems to be a Twilight Zone aspect to this, that how can this be happening?
Yes. So I think this Twilight Zone aspect, I think it's just a phase. I don't think it's going to last. I think what's going to happen is very soon we're going to lose the Arctic sea ice. So we'll have I call it the Blue Ocean event. No ice in the Arctic Ocean at the end of the melt season, say for the month of September, you know, 1 year, you know, whether it be this year, or there's low probability, but it could happen probably before 2020. And when that happens, the warming in the Arctic, which is, you know, we'll just continue and even accelerate, because now, you know, any heat going into the Arctic doesn't melt the ice. It actually heats the water on the surface of the Arctic Ocean. You know, and it'll happen for, you know, this Blue Ocean event will happen maybe for a couple of weeks or a month the first season. Within, you know, a few years, probably it'll last for 3 months of the summer, and then, you know, might be no sea ice August, September, October. And if the feedbacks kick in and are big enough, then there'll be no sea ice year-round, and we're in a much different state. We've gone through a regime shift, or, you know, a huge nonlinear change or an abrupt change to a much warmer Arctic. So the question I like to ask people is, okay, so in the case that the Arctic is almost the same temperature as the equator, what are the jet streams going to look like? Are there going to be any jet streams? Are there going to be weak jet streams because there's always going to be a humidity gradient, much more humid at the equator, much drier at the in the Arctic? Will the jet streams cross the equator and join with the southern hemisphere jet stream in a stable pattern, similar to what the ocean currents do right now? They travel from pole to pole. Right. So these are the questions to ask, you know, if the warming that we're seeing in the Arctic continues very rapidly, which all signs show that it will, how will that affect the jet streams? What will the new feature be? And we have some information from the previous interglacial periods when sea levels were much higher, temperatures were a bit higher than what they are today. Right. I mean, these are all the questions. I just ask a lot of questions about, so, you know, something, we're certainly going to have a much different world than what we have now. And my best argument would be that, yes, we are going to get a connection of the jet streams across the hemispheres. It's going to become, you know, and it's going to be, it's a strong mechanism for transferring heat from a colder, a hotter area to a colder area. So this is why. But I was completely misquoted in, say, the Washington Post article saying, well, the jet streams look like they're crossing the equator. This is a climate emergency. I mean, that's complete misrepresentation of every, you know, look at my numerous videos where I talk about climate emergency and the climate system and how this is happening. I mean, they obviously just did a hack job on my video, and they consulted a couple climate change denialists. And they consulted a meteorologist who thinks that the jet streams are behaving perfectly normal and haven't changed their behavior in the last 40 years, you know. They also quoted somebody who I respect greatly, who's done a lot of the work on relating the waviness of the jet streams to the Arctic temperature rise, Jennifer Francis, and she's done wonderful work. In fact, I met her at a conference. I said, you know, I think you should get a Nobel Prize for this work that you're doing. It's just, and it's still very controversial work. People still don't want to accept it. But for me, thinking of the overall system, of course, if the Arctic is warming like crazy, the jet streams have to change. They can't continue the way they are because of the, you know, looking at the overall system, it's just not possible. They're formed because of that temperature difference. Obviously, if the temperature difference changes, the jet streams will change. This is just common sense. But the climatologists who are specialists, they have to go off and crunch their numbers and do all their careful studies to come to this conclusion. Otherwise, but because it's not in the peer-reviewed literature, or it wasn't, or not much is, it doesn't exist to the specialists. Right. So this is a huge problem. When you have such specialized people, nothing exists, nothing happens unless it's in the peer-reviewed paper, even if the evidence is right before their very own eyes.
Well, let's go to a couple callers here. First, we have Phil. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Yeah.
Thanks for talking about this. What's got me is, and for a long time following the issue is how, and I'd like to get your opinion on it, is don't you consider this, in, at the bottom line, at the end of the day, a life or death matter situation?
Yes, I do consider it a life or death matter. In fact, just a few weeks ago, I did a YouTube video on, you know, what does too late mean? Because often in the language you hear, it's too late to do anything about climate change, or it's going to be too late in 10 years if we don't take strong action, or it was too late 20 years ago, you know, throw up our hands, we can't do anything. Now, what do people mean by too late? Some people mean it's too late for humanity. We're all going to go extinct. And there's a lot of people that think that way. You can just go on the different Facebook groups and see, you know, find groups of people, and they think, you know, just enjoy life now. There's absolutely nothing we can do. You know, some people even say we're going to go extinct in 15 years. I don't think that way. I think there's not, I mean, what does too late really mean? It's too late for probably people living on the coastline, you know, a foot above sea level in Bangladesh. It's probably too late for them to live where they're living for much longer. it's probably too late for many regions that are on the coast of Florida, for example, because we get a meter or two of sea level rise. You can't build a wall. I mean, it's limestone. The rock is limestone. It's dissolved by water. There's passages. You can't build a wall. The water would just come underneath the wall through the passages. And so people are going to have to move. So it's too late for them. It's probably too late for a lot of people living in countries like India with enormous population densities, because parts of India are experiencing 51 degrees Celsius temperatures. You know, what's that? 122 degrees Fahrenheit. I don't know about you, but I live in, where I am in Ottawa, it's when it reaches 30, 35 degrees Celsius. I mean, that's only about 100 degrees. Body temperature, 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit is your body temperature. That's 37 degrees Celsius. When you reach that type of temperature above your body temperature, of course, it's going to be very uncomfortable. You need to be able to sweat to cool your body down. And if the humidity is so high that you can't sweat, then you're outside and your body core temperature rises. You start getting heat exhaustion, heat stroke. You can't be outside. You just die. I mean, this is happening. We're reaching these conditions in places in the Middle East, for example, near the Persian Gulf. When the Persian Gulf water gets to be 30, last summer for large periods of time, it was 33, 34 degrees Celsius, which is very close to that 35 degree wet bulb temperature when you're 100% humidity and 35 degrees Celsius. So it's just, 95 or whatever the conversion is in Fahrenheit. Your body, you can't live outside. You have to have air conditioning. You have to have cooling.
The air conditioning is another terrible feedback loop that adds more fossil fuel emissions. But we got a couple more callers. Let's go to Jeff. Go ahead, you're on the air.
So it is life and death. Yes.
Jeff, go ahead. Are you there? Let's go to Michael then. Michael, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Good morning. Here's the thing that puzzles me. If this is the big emergency that lots of people say it is, why aren't we pursuing, and there's a particular thing that I think we should be pursuing, things like ocean fertilization? Seems to me like ocean fertilization, which is a process that was discovered because it occurs naturally, you got too much carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere, speed up the other side of the carbon dioxide cycle and pull it out of the atmosphere. It seems to me that if we got ocean fertilization working well, we could pull as much CO2 out of the atmosphere as we wanted to without hurting anything. So I don't understand all the people who go, oh, this is a big emergency, we got to do something. And there are these effective things we could be doing that no one's talking about, and instead it's all we got to stop burning fossil fuel, which just isn't happening, and as far as I can see, isn't going to happen.
Paul?
Yes, great question. I think that... The public will come to an awareness that this is an emergency. I think that will happen. People that don't think much about climate change, oh, it's a problem for the far future, will suddenly come to the realization, so there'll be a tipping point in human behavior, and people will panic and say, this is it, we've really screwed things up. What do we do now? And so I talk about this sort of a three-legged barstool solution. We have to zero fossil fuel emissions as fast as possible. That's leg one. We have to provide cooling of the earth to buy us time to do these other things that we need to do. And we can do this with, there's many different methods, and some of them are very benign, like taking seawater, spraying it up into the atmosphere, creating low-level clouds from the salt particles, for example. So I think that's leg two. And leg three is, carbon dioxide removal. We have to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. And fertilization, ocean fertilization, is a very interesting method that's actually it's been done off the coast of Canada a few years ago, and it stimulated phytoplankton blooms. And the oceans are also acidifying. The plankton counts are dropping in the ocean. And the oceans are getting much warmer, so like the chemistry is changing. And this is using up, so there, it's less conducive to having high levels of oxygen. So the oxygen levels are plummeting in parts of the ocean, and this is going to severely reduce food in the ocean. I mean, the coral reefs, we talk about the bleaching and the dying, but people don't realize that about a quarter of all the fish in the ocean spend some time on coral reefs. So with no coral reefs, do these fish exist anymore? Can they breed? You know, what happens to them? So we're stressing all of the ecosystems. So ocean fertilization is one great idea. I mean, what limits the ocean, the phytoplankton growth is nutrients in the, say, center of the equatorial Pacific. So if we bring nutrients from below, you know, like have, for example, up to the surface, we can stimulate phytoplankton blooms. Or if we add iron, we can stimulate phytoplankton blooms. So yeah, we need to really try to increase the CO2 sinks on the planet. So I don't think it's an emergent, but I think the first step is declaring an emergency and putting tremendous resources into addressing the emergency. And I'm talking about, you know, U.S., say the 700, 800 billion U.S. military budget. Imagine putting that towards this problem. Imagine having all those scientists and engineers designing more efficient ways to kill people. Imagine if they were designing devices to remove CO2 from the atmosphere to cool the planet and to replace fossil fuels with you know, much more efficient solar cells and wind and geothermal and all these other things.
But again,
I think that would go a long way to addressing the problem.
Well, again, the issue of geoengineering, many of us have resisted that tremendously, largely because the unintended consequences of our actions are what have gotten us into this serious predicament to begin with. And so there's a tendency for, you know, technical fixes to just create further unintended consequences. So, you know, what you're talking about is a complete revolutionizing of everything that we're doing, a complete coordination so that, you know, you don't have these technical fixes just creating more problems. You have, again, this complete coordination of the scientific community so that you're actually studying in rapid time, like within a year time, you know, give it a year. So you're trying to come up with the best solution for drawing carbon to the atmosphere that takes into account as much as possible the complexity of the systems that we're intervening in. And that's a very...
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yes. So... when people say geoengineering, I think almost always they're referring to solar radiation management. They're talking about things like sulfur in the stratosphere to cool the planet. Carbon dioxide removal is half. Geoengineering is not just solar radiation management, which sure many people are against, and I was until I realized how serious the climate system is now today. But carbon dioxide removal is as simple as don't cut down all of these forests, right? Keep these forests there because they're big carbon sinks. And we don't have forever to do this because look at the forests in California. We've lost 66 million trees in 4 years in California as a result of the drought and the heat. Of those 66 million trees, we've lost 26 million since September, October of 2015. So we've lost 26 million in 6-8 months. Like, so we're losing huge carbon sinks around the planet. The Amazon rainforest is stressed. Parts are still being burnt down and replaced to grow palm oil, palm trees for palm oil extraction. I mean, we're still destroying vast tracts of forests to do this. And so if we can stop doing these things, and if we can stimulate the life like plankton in the ocean, then you have zooplankton eating them, and then you get the fish, like you're stimulating the whole food chain up. So if we can restore some of the large fish in the ocean, the biomass, these are all things that take in carbon, right? Carbon makes up their bodies. So we've lost about half of the biomass on the planet, say, since the Industrial Revolution started, half. So if we were to just get back 15% of what we are above what we are now, this would draw huge amounts of carbon out of the atmosphere ocean system, more into the biosphere system. Right? So there's lots of things we can do, but we need to talk about these things. We need to declare an emergency to get these things done very, very quickly.
Well, we have Jeff back. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Well, I have two questions. One is, when you talk about an emergency, how soon is soon? And when you, since all events are weather and they're local, what sort of event can we expect that will really get broad attention? And I'll be happy to take my questions off the air.
Okay, so in terms of an emergency, again, people's view of emergency is different, right? I mean, you know, I love to scuba dive. I love the coral reefs. I think coral reefs are vital for the food chain in the ocean. I think coral reefs are, they're like the Amazon rainforest on land. The equivalent is coral reefs in the oceans. Also the plankton, the phytoplankton on the surface are vital because just about every second breath you take derives the oxygen from plankton in the ocean. So when these plankton numbers drop 40% in a few decades, you know, I'd say that's pretty severe. That's an emergency. When we're losing coral reefs, the water is too warm. I would say that's an emergency. Oceanographers that are, there's a meeting, the Royal Society is meeting in the fall on oxygen in the ocean, because the levels of oxygen have fallen 6 times faster than they've expected, than their models have expected. So they're having this conference. I would call it an emergency conference on oxygen in the ocean. They're calling it just oxygen in the ocean. You know, when food prices double or triple or quadruple, you know, many people would say, yes, this is an emergency. But, you know, we haven't had that yet. The Arctic changes, we're going to have an open blue ocean, Arctic ocean very soon, perhaps even this September, although I doubt it. It'll probably within a few years. Who knows exactly, because it depends on the local weather, how much ice is exported out. But when that happens, the extreme weather events that we're seeing, I think, will increase an order of magnitude, a factor of 10 or 20. So instead of a city or region being flooded out every 10 years, it'll be every few years, or, you know, we'll have 3,000-year events happening within a decade. You know, we're seeing all these things happening now. So pull the switch, call it an emergency, and let's start dealing with it on an emergency basis. So this is so immediately, I would say. And, you know, what will make people locally see things? Well, we're seeing things locally. Next time you drive across, you know, forested areas, look at all the dead trees, for example. You know, be they dead from pine beetle or emerald ash borer, or just there's a drought in California. Like, if that drought persists in California, those trees that have all died will not be replaced by trees. They'll be replaced by grasslands, maybe grasslands with a few trees every so often, savanna. The climate will not be able to support the weather, the precipitation and temperatures will not support growth of trees anymore in that region. So we're seeing all of these things happen. We just have to relate them to the big picture of the changing way heat is distributed, the changing jet streams, we're seeing ocean currents slow down. There's a big pool of cold water south of Greenland, which is indicative of that. Everything's changing, and it's there for us to see and join the dots, but there's not enough people that are studying the overall system. I mean, most of the opposition that I'm getting is not from deniers. It's from specialist scientists who are saying there's no peer review study on jet streams crossing the equator. Well, it's funny, because if you Google jet streams and equator, just look at things older than the last 2 weeks, because the video and Robert Scribler's blog was out last week in my video, try to find anything before, and there's almost nothing. And I've taken a lot of criticism from all sides, but I did kind of a tongue-in-cheek response, a couple of videos posted, a few days ago on YouTube, and last night on my website, paulbeckwith.net, but I'm studying the science and the incidents very carefully, and I'll be sure to let people know when I have some new things to talk about, you know, probably very soon on that particular topic. So,
well, we got another caller, but before I go to Blake, I just have this announcement that 9 on Political Perspectives in about 10 minutes, Argonne National Lab scientist Dr. Seth Darling speaks on the end of water as we know it, to continue the apocalyptic tone of programming here on KBOO. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. And if you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kbo.fm and clicking on donate. So you mentioned your own website, paulbeckwith.net. Robert Scribbler is a good one. D-Smog blog is another good one. And I'm sure through them you can find links to other stuff to at least try to get information in as much real time as possible as to what's going on. And of course, the responses, we've got our movement here in the Northwest to stop fossil fuel infrastructure. And again, there's going to be this important conference coming up tomorrow evening at the First Unitarian Church, 7 to 9 p.m. tomorrow, Thursday, Beyond Fossil Fuel Exports, A Just Transition to a Clean and Equitable Economy for Portland. Check that out. And we've got a few minutes left. Let's go to Blake. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for taking my call. A couple quick points I wanted to bring up. The first was cold temperatures apparently kill far more people than warm temperatures. I wanted to see what your guest thought about that. And the other point was the absolute level of carbon dioxide. We're roughly at 400 parts per million currently. And yes, it's gone up since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. I think we started at 270, but geologically, that's a very low number. In the past, we've been many times that, several thousand parts per million of carbon dioxide, which, as you know, is a life-giving gas. If we didn't have carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we would all be dead. We wouldn't be here. So it's part of the life cycle of the planet.
Paul, you have a response?
Yes, I do. On the carbon dioxide, yes. I mean, of course, we have the the biosphere. We have the plants which need carbon dioxide, and then they take the carbon out and they produce they emit oxygen, which then the animals breathe and do the reverse, produce CO2, you know, in respiration. So, but what we're seeing now is it's a change that is key. So we're in a stable range of 180 to 280 parts per million over at least the last million years, probably going back many millions of years. So we're in this range, and it would fluctuate up and down as the Earth's orbital cycles change, causing, you know, triggering ice ages and interglacials, like warm periods, cold periods, warm periods. So we're in that range, and since 1750, we've gone up to the 410. So we've had a very rapid rise in a short period of time. And to give you an idea, so that rate of change that we've had is, from what we can tell, that rate of change is at least 10 or 20 times faster than any other period in the history of the planet. So it's the rapid change that is occurring that is causing, you know, we're getting rapid temperature rise, and if CO2 rises, temperature rises. If temperature rises, that causes CO2 to rise. They're intricately connected. In some cases, CO2 rises first and then temperatures rise, or in some cases, temperatures rise first and then CO2 rises, and there can be some lags between those things happening. So yes, we've been stressing the cycles. So it's a rate of change that is really the key factor, the rate of increase in the greenhouse gases.
When the caller said we had thousands of parts per million, were there human beings?
Yes,
were there ever human beings
then? That's right. So we've had periods of the planet where we've had no ice on the planet. So no ice at the poles, sea levels were about 70 meters higher than today. The continents were in different places. It was a much warmer greenhouse gas planet. And we had the Carboniferous period, for example, is one period where we had this. It was very, very warm, and the leaves on plants were enormous. Creatures were much larger, like mosquitoes were the size of large, you know, hummingbirds or something. There was more oxygen in the atmosphere. We had a 30% oxygen level, or 30% at least in the oxygen. So the air was more dense, so it was a lot easier to fly. Yes, we've had periods like this, and CO2 levels were thousands of parts per million. And then we've also had cold periods where the Earth is, look up, Google Ice Ball Earth, it's thought that the Earth was almost completely frozen over from pole to pole, even at the equator, completely frozen over. But I think the latest view is it's more like slush ball Earth. At the equator, there might have been some open areas of water. And the CO2 levels were much, much lower even than 180 parts per million, I believe, in that case.
And these were not... These are periods that were not conducive to human habitation, apparently.
Yes, yes. I mean, we hadn't evolved. We could have easily lived in the Carboniferous, but, I mean, we were, you know, that was a period a long time ago. I mean, humans hadn't even developed. We've been around for, you know, we started, you know, it was about 2 million years ago walking, I guess, was started and things. I mean, our, you know, Homo sapiens, it's only been a couple hundred thousand years.
Well, listen, we got off on a sidetrack here, and we only have a minute left, so we're going to have to leave it there. So this is a incredibly important conversation, which is why I continue to harp on it here on my program. I try to look at it from a number of different angles. I really appreciate your taking your time, Paul Beckwith, talking about your specialty, actually, paleoclimatology and what it has to do with the present. I thank all of my listeners for calling, and I thank you, Paul. Any quick last words?
Yes. I think my purpose of saying we have to declare a climate change emergency is because if we just continue what we're doing, we're really, the risks to our society, to our existence on this planet, are huge. And I think it's unnecessary, these risks. I think these risks can be greatly reduced by this three-legged bar stool type thing. We need to start doing if the U.S. military is saying the biggest threat now is climate change, then they need to start spending money. Our defense budgets need to go to addressing this big risk. And then I think we can do a lot of different things. So this is a state I think that we need to reach in society. I think we will reach it very soon. The sooner the better.
Okay. Thank you, Paul Beckwith. This is a Wednesday Talk Radio. Paul Rowland, stay tuned for more programming here on KBOO Portland.